This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Millions of Americans across dozens of states are dealing with poor air quality because of the smoke caused by Canadian wildfires. And CBS's Scott McFarlane also reports the heat wave in the South is relentless.
Residents said the air smelled like a barbecue pit as it blanketed Pittsburgh. And coaches canceled swim practice near St. Louis.
They can get into some pretty rigorous activities, so we didn't want to expose them to the air quality at that time.
In the South, heat is the big issue, as more than 44 million people are under an excessive heat warning. Janet Chamlian is in Houston.
For construction workers like these and so many others, this is their office. There is no relief whatsoever from the heat. Right now, the surface temperature, where they've been working all day, has measured 123 degrees.
Advocates for a racially blind college admissions process are embracing the Supreme Court's ruling that colleges and universities can no longer consider race in admissions. Edward Bloom with the group Students for Fair Admissions says it's about time.
These discriminatory admissions practices undermined the integrity of our civil rights laws.
A former Florida sheriff's deputy is found not guilty of failing to act while on the scene of the 2018 Parkland High School shooting that left 17 people dead. Fired Broward County Deputy Scott Peterson says,
"Got my life back.
We've got our life back
after 4.5 years.
5.5.
And being able to put the truth out of what happened."
California is preparing for a peak wildfire season.
Governor Gavin Newsom says because of climate change, the past is no longer a useful guide for preparing the state for the future.
We can't necessarily attach ourselves to some of the more predictive models of the past.
Newsom says a new world requires new technology.
Real-time monitoring, 360 degrees, the ability to pinpoint through artificial intelligence precisely.
Christopher Cruz, CBS News.
Virgin Galactic takes its first paying customers into space, six of them, CBS News space consultant Bill Harwood.
Really a milestone for Virgin Galactic because it opens the door for downstream commercial space flights to carry more and more people up on these suborbital trips to the edge of space.
France braces for another night of unrest. CBS's Elaine Cobb explains why.
The death of a teenager shot by a traffic policeman in a Paris suburb Tuesday prompted two nights of violent protest. Now 40,000 police and gendarmes are being deployed across France tonight amid fears of renewed violence. One Paris suburb has slapped an overnight curfew on inhabitants, and public transport in the greater Paris region will finish early. The officer who fired the fatal shot has been placed under formal investigation for murder. Elaine Cobb, CBS News, Paris.
This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Walks, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation.
Here's what you need to know in western Wisconsin. Good afternoon, I'm Jimmy Kuska. Drought continues to expand in Wisconsin, now affecting over 81% of the state. That includes all of western Wisconsin, especially the lower Wisconsin River Valley, where the area of drought has doubled. Forecasters say some relief may be on the way, as Wisconsin is expected to have above normal precipitation over the next 6 to 10 days. A second person has been sentenced in the 2020 murder of a Hayward man. Ryan Steinhoff was sentenced to life in prison in Dunn County Circuit Court on Wednesday. The other person, Ashley Gunder, is currently serving a 25-year prison sentence. A third person, Chad Turgeson, was found not guilty during a jury trial. The three were charged in the murder of Bruce McGuigan. And a western Wisconsin city's growth is leading to more utility infrastructure. The city of Altoona is adding two new wells to serve its quickly growing population. That will bring the total to 9. Each well will cost about $1 million. Water demand has been high enough, even outside of drought conditions, for the city to restrict water usage. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
When it comes to achieving successful jury verdicts and settlements, one law firm stands out above the rest. Gingras Thompson & Walks, a $6.2 million settlement for a woman permanently paralyzed as a result of medical malpractice. $4.9 million to members of a family injured due to the negligence of a truck driver and his employer. Call Gingras Thompson & Walks today, 855-954-1186.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson & Walks, GTWLawyers.com.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
93.5, The Tap. It's what's on tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5, The Tap.
Our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Dark in the midnight sky. We feel the fire burning in the belly. The flame leaps out with an angry cry.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Supreme Court, original intent is make you slogging our way backward. And in very Supreme Court fashion, today they ruled that race-conscious admissions at Harvard, at the University of North Carolina, unlawful. Can't do it. No more. Sorry, it's over. This is bad. It's bad, according to our Supreme Court. 6-3 decision. You know which six, you know which three. It's not surprising. Interestingly enough, you know, they went after the affirmative action. Didn't go after anything else. Nothing else was tinkered with. And I think it's interesting that Ketanji Brown Jackson, one of the Supreme Court justices, said with "let them eat cake" obliviousness, today the majority pulls the ripcord and announces color blindness for all by legal fiat. But deeming race irrelevant in law does not make it so in life. Joe Biden's comment was, this is not a normal court. Yeah, Joe got that one right, Joe. This is not a normal court. This is the original intentist court. This is the corporate court. This is, well, not your grandparents' Republican Party court. These are activist judges. Remember that term? Remember how fun that was by the right? Activist judges giving people rights, expanding opportunities. Now we've got our activist judges who are taking us backwards. So the Supreme Court now says no more. Colleges can no longer use race as a determining factor on who they're going to admit into their esteemed institutions. But you know, they can try. They can try to have a diverse campus, you know, through other means. And you know there are no other means. And I think that's the point. So our original intent, Supreme Court, they are taking us back. You know, look, I've been saying this for a long time. There's nothing new here. There should be no surprise here. There should be no shock. None of this. They want to take us back to the good old days. The original intent of the Constitution. White, land-owning males, 21 and up. You're the ones who can vote. Everyone else, no. Blacks, 3/5 citizens. You know, put the women back in the kitchen, the gays back in the closet, and our minorities back in the fields. That's what this decision, that's what moves us towards. And if you're celebrating today, if you're a working class person and you're celebrating the end of affirmative action because it's just wrong, and you think somehow this is going to open doors for you and for your children, gong show, the big buzzer, it's not going to help. It's not going to do it. What this is going to do, this is going to, what it's supposed to do. Understand, who's supposed to be going to our esteemed universities? The well-heeled, the wealthy, our affluent. And this is another one of these moments where, you know, we just made it a lot easier for the next generation of Donald Trump's and George W. Bush's and them to get into Ivy League schools. Because it's who can pay. It has nothing to do with who can compete. This had nothing to do with this. You know, they want you to believe that affirmative action took places away from deserving people and that the people who are in there are undeserving, which is ridiculous. There are thousands of people who apply. All of them deserving. But they gave some preference. Now you go, how much preference? How much preference? I'm sure that, you know, Harvard's full of black students. And as Michael Steele, the former Republican national spokesperson, national chairman, pointed out, Harvard has a whopping 6.6% of their campus are black students. Yale, 6.5. Brown. You'd think Brown got to have, you know, half, right? 7%. Princeton, 4.7. Columbia, 5.1. Cornell, 5.0. So you go, wait a second. Hold on. Hold the phone. You know, blacks are what, 14% of the population? They're really underrepresented, even with affirmative actions. So what do you think is going to happen when this is taken away? You know what's going to happen. It's what's happened in places like Michigan. The number of black students who will get accepted and will be into these universities is going to plummet. That's what's going to happen. And it's not, understand, it's not going to open the door for your children. Your children still can't afford to go there. This is the other part of this. But the bigger part is, you know, they've overturned affirmative action and affluenza alive and well. Legacy admissions live and well. So you think of George W. Bush, couldn't get into the University of Texas, could get nowhere near the University of Texas, but somehow got into Yale. A C student got into Yale. Why? Because daddy went to Yale. Granddaddy went to Yale. Legacy. They give lots of money. And it's one of those things where you go, are you shocked? No, it's what we've done. So you look at the reality in where we are. Republicans have done a very good job of putting women back, you know, 50-100 years with the Dobbs decision, and understand contraception is next and all down the line, all of that stuff is coming back. You look at the next. They're going to go after the LGBT community. That's happening. There's so much coming here. And what's interesting to me, and I keep banging around in my head, that this is just part of the overall scheme to move us backwards. Now, you may remember there was a little scandal couple years ago, back in, you know, August 2020, you may remember a little bit. Aunt Becky got herself into a little bit of trouble. Remember Aunt Becky? You know, what was that? Full House. You know, this actress Lori Loughlin, her and her designer husband, you know, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to get their kids into USC because they want the best for them. And, you know, they ended up doing a little bit of jail time, you know, a little community service, some, you know, some fine money, all that stuff, because they wanted to get their kids into the U.S., into USC. And they didn't have the grades. In fact, this is the part that just blows my mind. They didn't even want to go. The kids are like, well, you know, if it'll fit into my schedule, you know, I want to party and I want to go to the games and I want to do all that, but I don't care about school. I'm doing my social media thing, doing my influencer thing. But they bought their way in, and they weren't the only one. I think, what were there, like 60 other parents that got caught up in this? Rich people trying to get their kids into, you know, big-name schools. And their kids are basically idiots But hey, they got money. Congratulations. The U.S. Supreme Court just said, you know what? You got the money. That's going to be enough to get you into these places. The money is going to be enough to get you where you need to be. And, you know, I keep coming back to this. This is not going to help working class people. And I know there's some are going to say, this is a huge victory for fairness. It's not. It's not going to help working people at all. It's just going to harm others. And our campuses are going to be much less diverse. Our campuses are going to have fewer minorities, even applying, fewer minorities graduating. And that comes with a whole sort of other bunch of problems. But you know what? Our Supreme Court, making America white again, dividing us up. And look, on the education front, this is another one of those things. I'm thinking, what's next? Is Brown versus Board of Education next? Are we going to go back to separate but equal? Are we going back to how far back will this Supreme Court take us? Now, look, you know, well, Rick, why do you care? You're a white guy. I care because I want working people to have an opportunity. What I know here, this is about the power and influence of the few. They didn't go after the legacy people. They didn't bother. And I saw a statistic that the majority of people who get into these places are legacy students. Because daddy and granddaddy, they both went, you're going to get to go. What happened to that meritocracy? Oh yeah, for you at the bottom, there's a meritocracy. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But for our elite, our Donald Trumps, who can't put a sentence together and went to one of the most elite schools in this country, as long as you can pay the freight, man, you're in like gold. George W. Bush used to joke about the fact that he was an idiot. He used to joke about the fact that the best he was a C student and got into Yale and a Harvard MBA. So don't tell me that there are undeserving people who got a hand up and that somehow that's harming you. It's ridiculous. Let's quick go to the phones. Who we got and what's on your mind?
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
This is like Simone. Have you ever heard of Simone Earle Sears, the lieutenant governor from Virginia?
She said
this is a great day of America.
Okay.
It ends discrimination by ending discrimination.
Okay.
And the mere fact that this is a beautiful day because we now know, just like Martin Luther King said, people are going to be judged by their character, their content of character, and not the color of their skin.
Yeah, I disagree with you. I think you're going to be judged by the depth of your wallet and how long your legacy at a university is going to be. You didn't go after any of the other privilege, which is interesting to me. You're going to go after the one hand up to poor and working class minorities that is there, that one pathway. You're going to go after that wholeheartedly. But the other stuff, the legacy stuff, we can't talk about the green. We can talk about color all we want. Talk about color to the sky turns blue, but we can't talk about green. Can't do that, brother. We just can't.
Well, you sure do limit the faith in kids, don't you?
No, I know how this
kids working hard and getting ahead.
Yeah, that's a nice frame, but in states that have already done this, we see what happens. Look at Michigan. Look what happened in Michigan when they limited the enrollment. The number of black students who applied, got accepted, and went through the programs all diminished. That's the reality. I'm not making that up.
Who brought this case to the Supreme Court?
Asian students.
Asian American. Yes.
Yeah.
So the mere fact that you want to place all the blame on white kids.
Did I say white kids? I said rich kids. Whoa.
Yeah.
I said rich kids. This is going to make the Lori Loughlins of the world very happy because they're not going to have schemes to get their kids into places.
They went to prison, didn't they, Rick?
Yeah. That's because back then that was illegal.
So
they don't have to do it now.
Don't stand with that either.
I don't stand with that either.
So I have trust in kids who work hard will get where they want to be. You don't.
I guess I've been on the other side of that. So I appreciate your thoughts, though. Thanks so much. Look, you know, at the end of it, that's the simple frame, you know. And look, I want people who are going to be able who work hard and play by the rules to get ahead. I've always said that. I believe in that. But we see what happens. We've seen through decades what happens, and we're going to see what happens now. I mean, we're going to go through this. And in a couple of years, we're going to be able to look back and see, you know, how did this work out and how many people did or did not make it through? Because it's the law of the land now. The court has decided. The six little dictators in robes, they made their choice. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Let's quick go to the phones. Got John and Madison online, too. John, how are we doing today?
Pretty good.
What's on your mind, brother?
Well, I'm just thinking in our wonderful Wisconsin legislature here, our legislators just cut the funding from the University of Wisconsin by another $32 million. And this is, of course, our gerrymandered in almost two-thirds majority from 48% of the voters, Republican legislature. This is the typical Republican mantra. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Oh, but we forgot to tell you, we're not only going to cut those bootstraps, we're going to take your sandals away.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys are just unbelievable. And now they're increasing the difficulty. It already cost my son about $75,000 to go to one of the University of Wisconsin satellite schools up at Eau Claire.
Wow.
For where he graduated. It's getting to the point where people can't afford to go to schools like that even.
No, and this is my problem with all of this. I mean, the sad reality is this is going to make it easier for the very wealthy to get into the most elite schools. It's going to make it much easier for those with deep pockets to go further. And working class kids like mine, like yours, are going to struggle. To me, it's not about white, black. It's about green. It's about money. It's about economic power. It's about affluence. To me, that's what this is about.
Yep. There's an old saying, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And that's exactly the aim of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I appreciate the call, man. Thank you so much. And look, that's the reality of where we are. I mean, you know, they know which side of the bread their butter is on. Let's go to the phones. We got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane.
So what's on your mind?
So what I wanted to say is this. So once again, our little ecumenical council there on the Supreme Court are showing their true colors and making their little decisions. And, of course, they're trying to dismantle it so that no one but the wealthy can get into the colleges. But the one silver lining to the cloud is this, Rick. Seriously, have you really been impressed with some of the Ivy League graduates, you know, like Jared Kushner and Rudy Giuliani and the Trump kids? I mean, I think they're all partying anyways. So maybe they'll all just have to get daddy to donate more buildings or something when, you know. But there's always that. But have a good evening.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. Now, this is, again, making my point for me. The reality is I want to be on the side of working class folks, people who are struggling. And, you know, one of the things that you know, I was thinking about earlier, and this idea of affluence, of living, you know, even, you know, an upper middle class kind of existence that gives you the ability to afford tutors and to be able to afford, you know, people to help you, you know, get through these tests. There's all kinds of, you know, programs out there for test prep and all this stuff that, honestly, where I grew up, the housing project I grew up in, nobody had money for that stuff. Coverage were bare most of the time. People were struggling to make ends meet. Nobody was getting an opportunity to go to Harvard out of our area unless you gave them a hand up. And I look at this affirmative action program as a hand up, not doing for. These are people who had grades that would get them into the school, because it's the frame that I love hearing from people is, well, they don't deserve to be there, which is ridiculous. You know, they had grades, they had the ability to get there, only they gave them a little bit of an advantage because they wanted a racial mix. This is kind of one of those things where you go, you look at our civil service exams, and our civil service exams have weighted points for different things. We want women to do certain jobs. We want minorities to do certain jobs. We want to give people with college educations, you know, more points. We want to give people who served in the military more points. It's the picking and choosing that I have a problem with. It really is. Because college admission is really subjective. Once you get past the grades, okay, everyone's got a 3.7 grade point average. Fine. Everyone except George Bush, who was a C student, 2.0. Once you get past that, everything else is subjective. So why aren't we talking about any of the other things that go into that? And of course, we're not going to. Because we're supposed to be focused on the racial component, the thing that divides us, black and white, or black and white and yellow. We're supposed to be pitted against each other. And look, would I, in a perfect world, love to have this right-wing meritocracy where the best and the brightest get into places? Yeah, there's part of me that says, yeah, okay. But there's also part of me that says, you know what? You know, working class people need a shot too. You know, I have a professor friend who told me today, grade point averages, those are worthless. That's not going to, that tells you almost nothing on how students are going to do in a college setting. It has almost nothing to do with their success as a college student. Their drive, their interest, their ability to perform. And he said to me, you know, the person who has the biggest challenges of all of the types of students you want to talk about are students from Appalachia. You know, white kids from Appalachia, they had the hardest time adjusting because they want to go home. They want to be home. They, in his experience, the most homesick of all of them. So how do you overcome those barriers? How do you help people achieve in this world? I mean, this idea that everyone's Horatio Alger going to pull themselves up by the bootstraps is, well, it's a nice fantasy. When the reality is there's a ton of invisible capital behind all of us. I look at the invisible capital behind Trump, behind you name the Ivy Leaguer. I look at our Supreme Court. How many of them got into the places they got because they were great students? No, because they were legacy students, because they had money, because they had a network of people who were pushing them. And it's this little thing. This is the part that blows my mind. It's this little thing, because as I pointed out, Michael Steele pointed out, the number of black students on these campuses, minuscule. So it's not giving them a huge leg up. But it is meant to divide us. It's meant to tear us apart. But we'll see where this takes us and what policies come next. What will the Biden administration do? We will find out. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day SWAC leader Philip Murray beat back reports that the Little Steel Strike had collapsed. Even as the steel companies were championing that the strike had been broken, Murray insisted that of the 90,000 workers involved, only 20,000 had returned to work in the mills that stretched across 7 states. He added, they were mostly supervisors and foremen and not production workers. Murray leveled charges against Ohio Governor Martin Davey that the Ohio National Guard was being used as company police to smash the strike. Strike leaders added that the companies were staging dummy back-to-work parades. In fact, Labor Secretary Perkins had announced that it was the government's effort at mediation that had collapsed. But the steel magnates were on the offensive and had the backing of local politicians and police. George Mike, a union man and disabled veteran, was the latest casualty in the anti-labor war. He was killed the day before at Maltrup Steel in Beaver Falls, Ohio, as picketers clashed with deputy sheriffs. In Indiana, police rushed to plant gates at Inland Steel to guard against new battles as 20,000 strikers prepared for the imminent forced reopenings of Inland Steel and Youngstown Sheet and Tube there. Both mills remained closed for weeks. In Warren, Ohio, police issued a warrant for CIO strike leader Gus Hall and two other strike leaders on charges that he was the brains behind a terrorist plot to blow up strike-bound steel mills. And at Bethlehem's Cambria Works in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, two separate dynamitings destroyed main water supplies, causing an immediate end to an attempted back-to-work movement there. The strike was far from over. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
When you think of Americans whose music has made a lasting difference, you might think of Scott Joplin, Woody Guthrie, Maybelle Carter, Harry Belafonte, or Roger Payne. Who? I came across Payne in a June obituary reporting that he had died at age 88. Yes, I occasionally scan the obits, not out of morbid curiosity, but because these little death notices encompass our people's history, reconnecting us to common lives that had some small or surprisingly large impact. Payne's impact is still reverberating around the globe, even though few know his name. A biologist who studied moths in the 1960s, he chanced upon a technical military recording of undersea sounds that incidentally included a cacophony of baying, shrieking, mooing, squealing, and caterwauling. They were the voices of humpback whales. What others had considered noise blew my mind, said Payne, describing them as a musical chorus of exuberant, uninterrupted rivers of sound. His life's work shifted from moths to whales, then to the interdependence of all species. At the time, whales were treated by industry and governments as dull, lumbering nuisances. But Payne's musical instincts came into play, sensing that the singing of these magnificent mammals might reach the primordial soul of humans. So he collected their rhythmic, haunting melodies into a momentous 1970 recording titled Songs of a Humpback Whale. It became a huge bestseller, altered public perception, and spawned a global Save the Whales campaign, one of the most successful conservation movements ever. This is Jim Hightower saying, so without writing or performing a single musical note, this scientist produced a truly powerful serenade from nature that continues to make a difference. To connect with Roger Payne's musical work and help extend his deep understanding that all of us beings are related, contact Ocean Alliance at whale.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about for the last couple of days, Bidenomics. Yeah, I got to tell you, love the fact that Joe Biden's coming out and taking credit for what his administration has done. I've been saying for a while, I want those big 20-foot cardboard cutouts of him pointing at stuff going, I did that. It's what we need. Democrats need to do a little bit better job of championing the things that they champion. Because you know, if Trump had done, you know, just a tenth of what Biden's accomplished, you would think he was the savior himself coming back to Earth. Because they're that good at patting themselves on the back. And here to share some thoughts on the big speech yesterday in Chicago and where we go from here with Bidenomics, I've asked Emily G to come talk with us. Emily is the Senior Vice President of Inclusive Growth at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So what'd you think of the big speech in Chicago yesterday? What'd you take from it?
So I thought it was a great speech. And as you said, you know, it's good to see him taking credit for the monumental things that are happening and these three historic pieces of legislation that have been passed in the first 2 years of his term. So he is, you know, very little sense putting his name on the agenda, calling it Bidenomics. It's an agenda that invests in America. It's one that has people in mind by empowering workers and lowers costs for all of us.
You know, yesterday I talked about the difference between, you know, Bidenomics now, which I think is great that you've coined something that we can grab onto, as opposed to supply side voodoo Reaganomics of the past, which got us into a lot of these messes. And I've been saying for a while, the reason that I like what Biden's doing is it's moving us away from that neoliberal kind of the trade policies, the outsourcing, those kind of things, and actually bringing stuff back.
It is. It's a recognition that markets are not perfect. You know, trickle down says if you, you know, let the money out, you know, out, go out there by cutting taxes and cutting back on government, it will all trickle down, which it doesn't. And it also hinges on the fact that markets work. I mean, you know, I think the private sector often has the best intents in mind, but there are things that they can't do alone. I mean, think about the interstate highway system that we all, you know, we all use on a daily basis. That was a you know, public works project, a massive public works project last century. And the investment agenda the Biden administration has put forward through these pieces of legislation rivals that in scale and scope to revitalize American manufacturing and also make sure that America is competitive in the world.
Now, my problem is, and this is where I have a problem with the administration, a lot of that investment seems to be going to places that hate him, that didn't vote for him. A lot of red states are getting this investment and then going, well, hey, how about how about Wisconsin? How about Michigan? How about, you know, Ohio's getting the chip plant? But how about Pennsylvania? How about other states that have lost jobs and industries too? How about we do some of that here?
So there are investment projects happening all over America. In fact, my colleagues and I at the Center for American Progress have a tracker that looks at both the public awards and the private investments. And to date, things are still ticking up, but we have 60,575 different investments that are happening all over the country, literally in every state. You know, you mentioned Michigan. We actually taken a closer look at a few projects in Michigan, you know, one of which is the Ford Blue Oval Battery Park project, $3.5 billion that Ford has committed to building EV batteries, building a factory from the ground up. It is not yet guaranteed to be a union plant. You know, they do have a deal for a car check with UAW, but you know, so I think there's still work to be done there. But I think, you know, there is potential to create union jobs where there are previously none. Another example, if I can, is there is a electric bus factory. Bluebird, the school bus company, is building electric school buses, which is cleaner, so also better for kids, you know, to not breathe in carbon emissions and you know, which is associated with asthma. That there's a plant down in Georgia that recently unionized in a territory that's traditionally been very hostile to unions. Yeah. And so I think, you know, there's reason to hope that by with these investments, and giving workers more skills and more job security, we can also improve unionization across the country.
No, I mean, you know, look, we did a tour back in October, And we went to a lot of places that used to be. They used to have a manufacturing plant in the town. That was their identity. It was the driver of their economy. And those places are struggling. And I argue that, that's what led to getting us Donald Trump. That people, you know, were frustrated. They didn't think people were listening. You know, jobs weren't coming back. The fact that Biden is doing this, you know, and has been doing it, I think is great. But I also think you got to go out there and you got to sell this. Part of, you know, these investments is the sales that come along with it. That, you know, do it, you know, tell people you did it, and then tell them you did it again, and then show them you did it. This, I think the administration needs to be doing more of.
And I think that's what they're doing on this tour that essentially, you know, the second round tour that essentially launched with that speech in Chicago you referred to. It's helping everybody understand that what they're seeing in terms of, you know, new roads and lead pipes being replaced with, you know, to give people cleaner drinking water. You know, these electric vehicle plants, changes that we're seeing to invest in solar and wind and renewable energy. These are, you know, not isolated things, but part of a cohesive strategy to build a greener economy and to revitalize American manufacturing.
You know, I'm sure you saw the tweets that went out from the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate, Tommy Tuberville, and also John Cornyn, the senator from Texas, basically, you know, saying, hey, look how wonderful this investment in broadband is. Thank goodness we've got this stuff. And they voted against it. You know, so I keep looking at, you know, the majority of Republicans who voted against these investments. I think it's important to point them out and call them out as well.
Oh, for sure. And I think it also just shows you how popular this stuff is. People want, economic security. People want jobs. And, you know, this agenda will deliver.
So let me ask you this, because part of the argument against doing this is all of this money that was being spent, all this money that's being invested is causing our inflation. It's Bidenflation, I'm told. Any response to that?
Yes, yeah, a couple of things. One is if you look at the inflation numbers, the most recent data we have are for May, we are down, and we're also on a downward trend in terms of inflation. So inflation is actually settling down. The U.S. is, you know, this has been a global problem. There are some global pressures, including the Russia's war in Ukraine, driving up energy prices, particularly in Europe. But, you know, the U.S. has got much lower annualized inflation than Germany and the U.K. and other developed countries. And, you know, it's starting to tick downwards. Grocery prices are coming down. And so, you know, inflation is getting under control. The other thing I'll also point out, too, is that, you know, part of the reason we're doing this investment is to, for the long run, give the U.S. greater protection, greater stability against, you know, external forces that can drive up prices, including things like improving America's energy independence by increasing wind and solar here at home, so we're not dependent on autocratic nations for oil and gas. It's also about making more things here in America and, you know, so-called friend shoring, making sure that our supply chains are not dependent on the whims of, say, China, you know, which is where we saw some shortages during the pandemic, not only for, you know, masks and such, but also for the chips that we need to make automobiles.
Right. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the pandemic woke a lot of people up to the reality of just how dependent we are on the rest of the world. And, you know, you go back and you think about, you know, the World War II era. You know, the reason we were able to prevail there is we had massive production capacities. We were able to turn our factories almost on a dime into war production. We don't have those factories anymore because we drove through a lot of places where those factories used to be, and they're crumbling.
Yes, and this is what's exciting about this is it's not just public money going out into these projects. It's creating an environment in which the private sector, you know, be it semiconductor plants, you know, automobile manufacturers, you know, energy and power plants, you know, people are, you know, there's private sector money being crowded in, spurred by the, you know, the tax credits and the environment that rewards making things here at home.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of this, you know, the direction I think we're heading is good. I like the fact that we're, again, you know, reshoring manufacturing, Buy American provisions. You know, that stuff's important to me, and I think important to working people, especially the Buy American part of this. I mean, if we're going to rebuild roads and bridges, it should be done with, you know, concrete that was produced here, steel that was produced here, because, not because I'm a nationalist and I think, you know, we're better than them, because we need an economy. People need jobs. There's a reverberation effect every time we spend a dollar on infrastructure that has to go through the rest of the economy. It just seems smart to me that you would want to have that kind of that snowball effect in your local economy.
Absolutely. And it's also about national security too. You want to be able to have, you know, not be reliant on countries that may not be friendly to the U.S. For crucial things like steel and semiconductors.
So what are we looking forward into the next? I know that the administration's doing their tour. We're going to see highlight some things over the next couple of days and weeks. What are we looking down at?
So I think we are just at the beginning. There are three big pieces of legislation that passed in the last couple of years. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, which as the name suggests is about semiconductors, but also about investing in workers' skills. And the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the biggest piece of climate legislation ever passed. Those are just what sets everything in motion. Now what happens is you have these investment commitments, public works projects announced by state and local government, large on the order of $1 billion investments announced by private companies to train workers and build new plants. So I think we are just at the dawn of the potential here. I think we will, we've already seen a dramatic increase in construction jobs, and eventually that will turn into jobs in manufacturing, and other things as these plants actually come online later.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Emily G. Emily is the Senior Vice President of Inclusive Growth at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website, if you want to check out the work that they do here. Now, I'm not a huge Elon Musk fan by any stretch of the imagination, but recently I saw a video of him saying, look, we need to get to renewable energies and quickly. We need, because it's in his view, it's entirely possible for us to get off of the dirty stuff and to move to renewables. Do you think we're moving in the right direction? Do you think we're moving quick enough? You know, I haven't seen it yet, so I'm curious what you're seeing and maybe help us along to see what maybe is coming.
So I think doing it quick is important. Doing it well is also important. I don't think those things are different. I sometimes hear people play this off as a trade-off, but I think doing it well is in many ways the same as doing it quick. So let me give you one example. If you have an electric vehicle, especially out west where I'm from, it can be a fair distance between charging stations. And so your choice to buy an electric vehicle will depend on whether you think you're going to get stranded because you can't find an operational charging station. And so getting consumer demand up, and therefore getting these companies to want to invest in supplying requires making sure that we have an environment in which people want to consume this stuff. So it is things like making sure that charging infrastructure is compatible. If every maker has its own plug, and then that limits the number of charging stations I might be able to use with my EV. And so there is a lot of role for government to help coordinate to shape markets to make sure that companies are making things that consumers want
if you're going to have it for business. If you're going to have the infrastructure, it's got to be usable.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, another example is the power grid, right? If you don't have the grid to support car dealers and manufacturing plants, then you don't have an environment that's going to be ready to go for those new vehicles.
You could say this one of two ways. We got a long way to go, or you can go, we got a long way to go. And it's good because, there's going to be jobs, there's going to be opportunities, there's going to be all this stuff. The future is bright, or you can look at it as, we're never going to get there. I want to believe we're going to take this on, because I still think we're a country who can do big things, even as divided as we seem to be. And this is one of those things I'm hoping we can do. But Emily, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing some thoughts. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Emily G. She is the Senior vice president of inclusive growth there at the Center for American Progress. Check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day that American folklorist Archie Greene was born in Winnipeg, Canada. His father was a Ukrainian refugee who had fought in the 1905 Russian Revolution. As a young boy, his family moved to Los Angeles. There, he enjoyed listening to cowboy songs on the radio. Archie grew up to become a shipwright and a carpenter, but he never forgot those cowboy songs. At the age of 40, he returned to college at the University of Illinois to study labor history. He wanted to learn about the songs and the stories at the heart of the U.S. labor movement. He was interested in what he dubbed labor lore, the folklore of working people. For 7 years, Archie led the effort to get Congress to pass the American Folklife Preservation Act. Finally, in 1976, Congress unanimously supported the act. The act allowed for the founding of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. The center helps to collect the stories of the working class. Archie wrote books and essays about workers, including miners, tinsmiths, millwrights, and the Sailors Union of the Pacific. In 2007, he helped to edit the Big Red Songbook. The book includes the lyrics of nearly 200 labor songs. These songs had been included in various editions of the Little Red Songbooks published by the Industrial Workers of the World between 1909 and 1973. Archie Greene understood that workers' stories deserved to be remembered and told. He spent 5 decades as a scholar and advocate for these stories. His work has helped to preserve the record of working-class life in America for generations to come. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I love this story. The U.S. Department of Labor, they are suing this national customer service service. And, you know, I've gotten some flack for my belief that we need to rein in this independent contractor, this gig economy kind of stuff, that employees should be employees and they should be treated as such, paid as such, and taxed, you know, all of that. The unemployment, the workers' comp, the state and local taxes, all that stuff as an employee. And I've said, look, you know, there are places for independent contractors. You're an electrician, you do jobs, you know, one house to the next, whatever. You're truly an independent contractor because you control your own work. You control your time. You're not doing a job that someone would normally be doing, all of that. This story caught my attention because this Florida-based customer service provider, you know, the people who annoyingly call you on the phone, and you know, whatever, or you end up calling them. And I guess they did work for Barnes & Noble's, Comcast, Disney, Walgreens. So if you called, when I called Comcast to check how bad my internet is, I probably may have talked to one of these people. And what they did in Florida is they, again, Florida, they made it so all of the people who you're calling and talking to on the phone as customer service reps, they made them all independent contractors, all gig workers. In fact, what the Office of Solicitor lawsuit says is that they expected workers to pay for mandatory training while attending courses offered through the company's proprietary software. So they're saying, you know, you're going to have to come to school. You're going to have to pay for school. You know, our school and our software and our stuff, you're going to have to pay for all this. And oh, by the way, we're going to make you do multiple weeks of this, and we're not going to pay you anything. You're going to come to school, pay us, and, you know, whereas in the past, we would hire you, we would train you to do the job, you'd be an employee, you'd get health care and retirement and wages and all that. No, that's all gone. You're now your own boss. They required all of these people to set up their own limited liability corporations or join existing corporations so that for the purpose of getting around labor laws. Also made them sign arbitration agreements. So even if you wanted to sue them under the Fair Labor Standards Act for not paying minimum wage or overtime or anything, can't take them to court because you signed this arbitration agreement. And you go, well, how many people is it? They're talking 22,000 workers. 22,000 people they conned into signing up to be their own boss. You're going to be your own boss. You're going to make huge money. And, you know, it reminds me of, you know, some of the trucking things that I remember years ago. You know, I remember a guy worked for MS Carriers. I don't even think they're in business anymore. But it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. We're at a little truck stop and it's just a handful of people around. And this guy's feeding his credit card and his ATM cards into the machine. Nothing coming out. And he's frustrated and he's angry and he's ticked off because he can't get a sandwich. So I offer to buy him a coffee and a sandwich because he looked distressed. I help a brother out. You know, I'm a union organizer, so it opens up the door to, you know, to start talking to people and have conversations. And he tells me this story. This story of how he's going to be his own boss. He's the truck he's got out there, he's leasing. In 7 years, it's going to be all his. Completely free and clear. He just has to work for, at the time, 23 cents a mile. Whereas as a union driver, I was making 51 cents a mile. So he was making less than half. I mean, barely able to get by. And the money that they were supposed to pay him never really got into his paycheck. He had to fight for it all the time. And they never gave him enough fuel. And it was a whole debacle, but he was his own boss. They told him where he had to go, how he had to get there, when he had to get there, what, you know, what clothes he had to wear, but he's his own boss. And at the end of this conversation, as we're going through this, I ended up breaking his heart. And I didn't mean to. I don't mean to be Debbie Downer all the time, but the reality is in the trucking industry, you own a truck for 7 years, you're going to have over 1 million miles, and it's going to have to go through a ton of rebuilds and maintenance and all kinds of stuff that the company doesn't want to deal with. So you basically worked for half of what you should have worked for, and you've got a piece of garbage that they ended up dumping on you in the aftermath because they weren't going to want to do all the work that had to be done. It was a great scheme for the company. And we see this model being played out time and time again, where working people are the ones who continually shoulder the burden and the risk. Because we all want to be independent. We all want to have a job that we love doing and that gives us flexibility to spend time with our families and vacation. We want that infomercial at 2 a.m. Sad reality is somebody's getting rich. It's not you. Somebody's lying in their pockets. It's not these workers who had to show up, go through a training program, not just unpaid, but had to pay for their training. And then set up a corporation to shield the real company from any liability, insurance or otherwise. It's quite a racket. And this is what I've been saying for a while, why I'm against a lot of the gig stuff. Because we now know that, you know, eventually it's going to be warehouse work. It's, you name it. It's going to be whatever. We're all going to be little LLCs, and we're all going to have to, you know, get out there and hump for our supper. Now, there's some who think that's a great idea. As a union guy, I'm like, look, corporate America wants to make profit off our back. We're going to make some of that back. We're going to do well. But we're in a moment where this stuff is being sold to us as, whoa, it's going to be great. It's the greatest thing ever. This guy that I met, he really believed until I broke his heart that he was living the dream. that he was working towards something, that something was going to, it was going to break for him. It was tough now because he was pulling himself up by the bootstraps. He was doing the hard work. He was putting in the hours, putting in the time, doing the miles. You know, I think about that guy quite often because I wonder what eventually happened to him, because MS Carriers went out of business a short time. I believe it was a short time after that. And I wonder what happened to the truck. I wonder what happened to him. Because this is a guy who worked hard. I want that guy to succeed. I want him to do well. I want every person who's